I'm talking with Jerry Pippin, a journalist who has covered the Kennedy assassination for literally 50 years. He will update us on the latest information, and also he'll be talking about and actually reviewing Larry Sabatow's latest book, The Kennedy Half Century. Sabatow had a news conference the other day. He also sent out a press packet with a poll in it that he commissioned by the Hart people, and we covered that before on a Friday Jobber, one of our programs, Boston Red programs. And also in the pre-part, we'll talk a little about the ballistic part of it involving the Dictor Belt. And you'll hear the Dictor Belt before Jerry, and then we'll get into his review of Sabatow and the facts involved there. And he will also talk about a book put out by the Secret Service agents that were there on that day. Clint Hill, the man, if you recall, he was the one that jumped off of the follow-up car and ran to the limousine and pushed Mrs. Kennedy back into the presidential limo. And the fellow that was the lead writer, Jerry Blaine, also one of the Secret Service agents that was involved, although he was sent to Austin, Texas. So those are the two, the Kennedy detail and then Sabatow's book. And as Jerry will tell you, there are hundreds of other books out there. So now we'll go on to Jerry Pippin speaking to me live from the hometown of the conservative senator who voted to not reopen the government or extend the debt ceiling, one Tom Coburn.
Okay, we're going to listen to the dictaphone and see the Larry Sabatow's book's based a lot on this dictaphone recording. And a lot of people don't even know what a dictaphone is. And basically, a dictaphone was a belt that ran in a machine that you set on your desk and you talked. I'm not sure why the Dallas police recorded anything on the police radio traffic on a dictaphone. There were wire recordings, and also tape was around in 1963, even though it was certainly not as easy to use as cassette recordings later. But the real tape was definitely there. So I'm not quite sure why the dictaphone is one they've been using all the time. Because as you listen here, you see the dictaphone quality is not very good at all. As you can tell, how Sabatow could decipher anything out of that dictaphone is beyond me and that recording. I've had experience with dictaphones. My partner in a radio station I owned, an FM station back in the 60s, he dictated everything to his legal secretary on a dictaphone, and she would spend literally all day sometimes trying to decipher what he had dictated. And this was quite common with secretaries around the country. As a dictaphone, he used a belt, and it certainly was not very high quality at all. Now, you had 50 years of it setting around and the deteriorating a little bit, and it's a miracle that anything could be deciphered from that dictaphone. Now, I want to get into some of the Sabatow evidence and where the fallacies are. But before we do that, I think I need to get into a little background about 50 years. 50 years, we've had the same muddled confusion about the Kennedy assassination as we do almost every conspiracy. And you sometimes wonder why these things happen and play out this way, but part of it's human nature, and part of it is that the establishment at the time never really releases the full details. And we've seen that even in today's political world, that the government seems to love secrets even when they aren't secret anymore. Now, we're going to listen to a recording from C-SPAN a little later on with the two secret agents involved. And before we get to that, I'll give you a little background on that. but I think you'll find it interesting, especially when I give you the background on it. But the background really needs to, I guess, an overview would be the best way to summarize what I'm getting ready to say. And that is that it's been 50 years, and we still are no closer to a solution than ever, ever. Now, what has happened is people have been polarized into the positions. As you listen to the Secret Service men, they're willing to buy into what the Warren Commission and other reports of the official story is, and that Lee Oswald was the shooter. An interesting surprise, we're going to play the police chief of Dallas, Chief Curry, in an interview, and he tries to muddle the water even more, and I'll tell you about Chief Curry in a moment as well. But the point that I want to make here is that it looks like most of the people, the Undertaker has taken most of the players, and they're no longer around, there's no longer a witness, and the chances of us actually getting a regular, detailed report of what happened with the Kennedy assassination, with everyone believing it, after 50 years of obfuscation by not only the U.S. government, not only the Secret Service, but also by the researchers themselves. I know many of these researchers have done many interviews, and many of them are on my website at jerrypippin.com. And each one of these researchers, I think, believe what they come up with. And when you're dealing with circumstantial third-person answers, where you're looking at the notes on television and the YouTube recordings of kinescopes is what they used back in those days. The quality was very, very, very inferior. What it was they literally ran a film camera over a cathode tube, which was how television was broadcast in those days, and the quality sucked, to be I guess, blunt about it. And so we have that as well. We also have some recordings, which were pretty good, from the networks and some other places, especially the audio of these things. But here again, even the Walter Cronkite famous announcement of Kennedy being dead, when he had to take his glasses off and the tears were coming out of his eyes, even that was a kinescope. So if I'm not mistaken. So the point here I want to mention is that technology today has by far surpassed everything that existed in 1963. And in 1963, we really thought we were uptown, because I was in broadcasting before the Army, and during the Army I did some radio work. And after the Army, of course, my career really took off. But the point is that during this time, I was in the Army at the time that Kennedy was assassinated, by the way, and it was quite a shock to everyone. And basically, no one really knew what to make of it. And they had immediately they centered in on Lee Harvey Oswald, almost like magic. And the point is that Lee Harvey Oswald, later on television at the Dallas police station, said that I'm a patsy. Now, a lot of people didn't want to believe that. I'm inclined to believe it, even though if you listen to some of the interviews we're going to do with the two Secret Service men, you'll find that they are willing to buy into it, that it was Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone, and they buy into the story that he was a fellow who just couldn't pull anything off and decided that he'd kill the president to prove that he was a man to be deal with. That may be a stretch, or maybe that's true. Who knows? That's the problem. After 50 years, no one really knows anything. Now, they're going to release more official details in 2 or 3 years from now, but the fact is, the 50th anniversary, we're going to be inundated with all kinds of theories, all kinds of people preaching the gospel, according to Lee Harvey Oswald and others, with contrary theories or hypotheses. And over 100 JFK books have been written, and probably another 20 are added to it over this November period, that we're getting ready to really center in on the JFK assassination. Now, later on, our plans are to, after the assassination, and around December or so, we are going to use some recordings made of Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One flying back to Washington and all of the radio traffic that happened. And we're going to use that recording in a way to weave the story in detail. And this will be quite a serious undertaking and will take us several weeks to put it together. And as you know, I've been recuperating from illnesses, and I haven't had much time to work on it during this time, but I do plan to start in December working on it again. So I'm not through with the JFK assassination by any means, but I just want you to say the evidence shows what you want it to. You can use the evidence and pretty well convince yourself that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman. Or you can take the same evidence and take it with a viewpoint that there was a cover-up and that actually, as Lee Harvey Oswald said, he was a patsy. And a lot of very, very intelligent men with decent and really unchallenged backgrounds in journalism and investigations have come to different conclusions. And this has served to muddle the waters. But let's get back to Sabatow's book. Sabatow is a professor specializing in politics at the University of Virginia. And he has been a political commentator for some time, an analysis person. His politics lean from, however how you want to look at it, from being the establishment voice to somewhat conservative. Now, it's interesting that he came out with this book on the 50th anniversary, and it's a big, thick book. It's a lot that I think could have been written, and a lot shorter than what he wrote. It just seems that each year they keep coming up with an establishment book that pushes the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. We had Gerald Posner's book two or three years back, which later became a little discounted, and Posner was a respected author, but he pretty well had some holes in his book, and so does Sabatow. One of the things that Sabatow insists on, because he's concentrating on the story that the Dallas police motorcycle person had his microphone stuck, and you could hear the three shots from the grassy knoll. And in addition to another shot. And Sabatow tries to debunk this, and he uses his dictaphone, which is unintelligible, really. In addition to that, he says that the motorcycle driver was 2 miles away. And he said that the motorcycle driver did not escort the presidential limousine with Kennedy, who was dead probably by then, and his wife, and they sped down underneath the underpass that got onto the expressway to go to Parkland Hospital, and he says that there was only one motorcycle. Well, Boston Red looked at the evidence, saw the videos again, he counted three motorcycles in that episode after the shots were fired and the Secret Service man jumped out of the car and got on the back of the other car and pushed Mrs. Kennedy down. And so We can discuss more of that in a moment, and we will. And we're going to play an interview from C-SPAN years ago, not that many years ago, but some time back, in which the interviewer, actually, he was the head of C-SPAN at the time, does a very good job talking to the Secret Service men. Now, one of the Secret Service men was driving the car, and many researchers and many people I've talked to over the years are convinced that he slowed down. But the car, the presidential limo, as you'll hear, was going 11 miles per hour, and it actually made a turn there just as the shots came out, and it slowed down probably to 5 or 6 miles per hour, almost to a stop. Now, a lot of people have said that that Secret Service man was in on the killing. We've heard this many times. There's another theory that there was a Secret Service man with a high-powered rifle that did it. Then we have the three shooters on the grassy knoll with several witnesses testifying to that. And so the thing is, to be kind, of all of the eyewitnesses we hear and all of the upfront evidence we hear about what Lyndon Johnson might have said later and what this was said and what was this said, is a fact that they're all contradictory, and none of it can be proven. It's he said, she said, and unfortunately, we haven't been able to nail anything down positively, 100% positive, that is. Now, I think the evidence, contrary to many people in the media, I think that there's plenty of evidence that it's probably not Lee Harvey Oswald that did the shooting. And we'll discuss that in a little bit more detail in the future shows. And the Secret Service men do address this. And there was a toll taken on those two Secret Service men. One of them ended up having a very serious drinking problem and depression. But they then recovered, and they were able to do this interview, and they wrote a book, which we talked about at the top of the show, Boston Red introduced it, and it's in great detail about how they did it. Now, I can testify in person that the back then, when Kennedy was president, the Secret Service presence was minimal, because I saw JFK come to the University of California, Berkeley, one day. And he had a motorcycle, two motorcycles in front of him, a Secret Service car in the back, and he had the top down in the car, and he was waving to everybody. He could almost reach out and touch him. And, of course, that's a far cry from what's happening now, as we now are, I think, oversaturated with the evidence of security, and probably have gone a little too far, but that's only my opinion. Let's talk a little bit about, before we play this interview with the two Secret Service men, there's a theory there that we need to cover, and that is that the driver was in on it. The theories abound, and we're going to play something by Chief Curry of the Dallas Police Department, and there's some evidence. He was a right-wing conservative, and there's some evidence that he was at the home of Clint Murchison the night before, along with many other people who were Kennedy haters, including H.L. Hunt, who had a canned goods kingdom. And H.L. Hunt spent all of his money on 15-minute radio shows in the evening, where they spent all the time giving out ultra-conservative dogma, a long, long time before Rush Limbaugh, but basically it was the same approach. And it was pretended to be a regular newscast, but it was far, far from that. So everybody was at Clint Murchison's house that night, and Clint Murchison was one of those people who was an ultra-conservative as well, a John Birch Society member. Or two were there as well, and the rest of them were very sympathetic to the John Birch Society, including Chief Curry. Now, I bring all this up for a reason. Lyndon Johnson showed up there in the evening, I think it's about 8:45, and suddenly everybody got quiet. And Lyndon walked in and said hello to everybody and talked to this group of conservatives around the dinner table. And knowing Lyndon Johnson, at least by reading his historical background and people who knew him well, I came to a conclusion a little different than my good friend Jim Morris did, who believes that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the assassination. I came to an opposite conclusion. My conclusion was that Lyndon wanted to go in and needle these guys, and he had gotten word as vice president, there's no secret, Secret Service and other investigators, you couldn't keep a secret with these guys. And so he went over to Clint Murchison's house and just walked in, probably to needle one. That's my opinion. Now, did Lyndon Johnson know about the assassination? I'm not so sure. A lot of people believe he did, but I think perhaps he figured it out later. He's a smart man. And he learned to keep his mouth shut over it simply because I guess the best illustration of that is a story that has a lot of documentation. People tell it for the truth that when they left Parkland Hospital to go back to Air Force One, Lyndon Johnson grabbed Jackie Kennedy and pushed her down on the floorboards and said, "They're going to kill us. They're going to try to kill us all. Stay down here." And the point is that later on, Lyndon Johnson was able to get his programs through with some help and no blockage by the conservative Republicans. And a lot of people, including myself, think that that is part of the payoff for Lyndon to keep his mouth shut later on. Now, Lyndon Johnson had worked all his life to get the poverty program, get the war on poverty, get Medicare, and several other programs through the Great Society, as we learned to identify it. And Lyndon Johnson broke all kinds of records. Now, he was very good at taking an enemy on the political front, a conservative Republican, walking right up to him, looking them in the eye, grabbing them by the lapels, and telling them what he wanted done. And he got his way a lot because he yielded a lot of power. And interestingly enough, Lyndon Johnson did not run for a second term, and I think that's because he was sick and tired of the Vietnam War, but he couldn't really say much about it because he was instrumental in getting us involved there. And that was part of the military-industrial complex's bargain with Lyndon Johnson, in my opinion. And the reason I judge this is I find the real reason for the assassination of JFK is not only that you had a perfect storm, he'd already had the Bay of Pigs, and the CIA was upset with him. They pretty well had taken, talking about Kennedy, had taken the authority away from them. In addition to that, he had given Grumman Aviation, an upstart company, a huge fighter contract. And in addition to that, Boeing and the others were terrified that Kennedy was going to be a loose cannon and not play ball with the military-industrial complex. In fact, Kennedy was already making some noise about getting our special advisors out of Vietnam, even though the military-industrial complex evidently had planned to use this to get a big bankroll from the Uncle Sam, from the U.S. government, as they fought a war on and on and on. And, of course, we know the history. That's the way it played out. Now, what they were afraid of down in Texas, and this is the reason I say that I named all of those players that were Clint Murchison's house, is that Kennedy is going to spend a fortune by those terms in those days on putting a man on the moon in a decade. And the aviation companies could, the aerospace companies could feel and taste the money coming in, as there would be no really limit on the expenditures, because we are in a race for the moon with Russia, or at least it was portrayed that way. And remember, Russia had got into space before we did with Sputnik. So everybody was on edge, and everybody in Texas and the aviation companies were afraid that what Kennedy was going to do was move NASA, which was on the drawing board at that time, to Boston and away from Texas. And so what better way than Lyndon Johnson, who was the vice president, would be more inclined to keep all of the money down in Texas, which he did. And we all know that NASA ended up in Houston. So I think this is one of the major reasons for the assassination, and that's money. And, of course, there were other enemies of JFK. If you think the right wing is bitter now, back in those days, when the John Birch Society was there, Kennedy was the biggest demon that ever lived, according to these people, even though by the general population he was a popular president, and the people loved him, and loved Jackie and the entire Camelot regime there in Washington, D.C. So let's listen now to this interview with the Secret Service men. Remember, one of them was the driver, and many researchers believe he was involved. They believe that he slowed the car down slow enough that shots could be fired. Now, we also have an interview with Chief Curry, who was a right-winger, but he kind of muddles the water. And remember, that's how, and we still do it today, that's how we obfuscate things and get facts covered up, is you get people who you think are guilty, all of a sudden they come up almost agreeing with you a couple of times. And Curry mentions a possibility of another shooter in this interview. It's all very, very strange. And it's been strange for 50 years. And I submit to you, before we go to the tape, that it's strange that you could not solve this murder, and that's what it was. We dress it up as an assassination, but it was a murder of the president, and a lot of evidence, but somehow we just never really got to the bottom of it. We got two competing theories. Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do it. And that's kind of where it is 50 years later. Just unbelievable. I've come to the conclusion that we probably won't prosecute anybody, even if we found out that there was a conspiracy to commit murder on the President of the United States. Listen now to these sound bites.
There's a possibility that one could have come from in front of us. We've never been able to prove that. But just in my mind, and by the direction of the blood and brain from the president from one of the shots, it would just seem that it would have to be fired from the front rather than behind. I can't say that I could swear that I believe there was one man and one man alone. I think that there's a possibility there could have been another man.
Driver of the car, Bill Greer, was running the presidential vehicle closer to the left-hand side of the street to keep the president, who was in the right rear, away from the crowd on the right. Well, that put Mrs. Kennedy right next to the crowd, and the motorcycles would have to drop back. So I occasionally, down Main Street, would go from the follow-up car, get up on the back of the car.
What was your job during this trip?
I was responsible for Mrs. Kennedy's protection. And I did that four or five times until we got to the end of Main Street. When we turned right onto Houston, the crowds dissipated. There were very few people. And so I got back in the follow-up car. When we turned left on Elm, right in front of the school book depository, there were very few people on the left, two people on the right. There was no reason to be on the back of the car, and we knew we were about to hit the Stebbins Freeway and Expressway, and we were going to go at freeway speeds, which meant there wouldn't be agents on the back of the car anyway. So there were no agents on the back of the car at the time the incident occurred, but it was partly because we were about to hit a freeway and partly because he didn't want them there.
Joe Blaine, what was your job?
My job at that time, after I came back from Tampa, I was supposed to go to Dallas to help Win Lawson complete the advance. But we had an agent who had some connections in Dallas, so I joined the midnight shift. And we worked from midnight to 8 and in the White House, and then we caught a twin-engine Navy plane and flew to Fort Worth and stood watch that night. The next day when the assassination occurred, we just arrived in Austin, Texas.
And were you just on the detail, on the presidential detail, or were you running? I mean, what was your title?
I was a special agent on the detail. I'd been on the detail for 5 years. Like Clint, I'd started with President Eisenhower.
How long did you work for the Secret Service?
It was just a little over 5 years
total
when I left, yeah.
Clint Hill, how long did you work for the Secret Service?
17 and a half years.
And why did you leave?
I was forced to leave because of retirement, disability retirement.
Do I remember correctly that you were 43 at the time?
That's correct. I was 43 when they retired me.
What have you done since then?
Mostly just been retired. I tried a few businesses which didn't succeed.
From that day, I would say there are about 17 that are still alive of the people that worked on the Kennedy detail from 1961 on.
How many total would have been on the detail?
Well, at any one time, there were 34 agents on the president's detail and 6 agents on Mrs. Kennedy and the children's detail.
Now, we've got some video from YouTube. One of the things you say in your book that made you want to write this book was all the conspiracy theories, and you talked about the movie from Oliver Stone. This is a man named Vince Palamara. Do you know him?
I'm familiar with him. I don't know him.
He says that, I guess, that, we'll talk about this, that he sent you a 22-page letter.
I recall receiving a letter which I sent back to him. I didn't bother with it.
You didn't talk to him ever?
He called me, and I said hello, but that was about it.
And over the years, have you both been called about this assassination on many occasions?
I've been called numerous times.
What's been your attitude? How have you approached people?
For the most part, I've just said I have no comment. I just have nothing to say.
And why is that?
Well, most of it's from people who are writing conspiracy theory books that don't make any sense to me. So if they're not going to deal in fact, then I don't want anything to do with it.
And how about you? What have you been?
Same thing. I have never talked to an author of a book. And I just felt we have it on our commission books, worthy of trust and confidence. And I felt those were issues that you should never talk to anybody on the outside about. And it was, I had to weigh and evaluate when I wrote this book, because I felt I wasn't talking about the Secret Service. I wasn't talking about the Kennedy family. But I was talking about the agents that I worked with and the incidents that occurred. And those were my friends, so that's what I decided to write.
Did you have to get permission to do this from the Secret Service?
No.
So this wasn't cleared by the Secret Service?
No.
Okay.
No, but we had lunch today with the director of the Secret Service, who thanked us very much for our contribution.
Here is this video. It's not very long, and this man's name is Vince Palamara. He's a citizen who has taken it on his own to become an expert. He's from Pennsylvania, and I don't know him. I've never talked to him. I've just seen it on the web, and he is, I believe he's a graduate of Duquesne University. So let's watch this, and I'll get your reaction.
Okay. Hi, this is Vince Palamara, the self-described Secret Service expert that Jerry Blaine accuses me of without naming me, okay? Back with my obsession about the Kennedy detail. I gotta read this. This is rich. Page 287. This is what Blaine's claiming Raleigh said. Raleigh turned to Jerry Blaine, and Jerry, since you were in the lead car, did you ever hear this over your radio as well? Yes, sir, I did. I heard exactly what Floyd just told you. The thing about this is the whole thing about the Ivy League charlatans thing. Jerry Blaine told me the Ivy League charlatans thing came from the guys. I can't remember who said it. Boy, his memory got real good 5 years later, because now he's claiming he heard it over the radio, Floyd Boring, okay? Just unbelievable. It's just amazing to me, you know? There never would have been a book if I didn't send a 22-page letter, okay?
Plus at the time. Fascinating. All right. Let's see. And I wanted to make one point. You know, we're here because of a very sad event, but we don't want to make this a sad occasion. I'd like to pass on to you a story that came to me while I was about halfway through the book. It did not occur to me until I read a passage in the book. Now, let me take you back to Denver, Colorado, and both Jerry and Clint worked in the Denver office of the Secret Service, but not at this time. In 1963, I think it was,